Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And this very delayed discussing episode, it was recorded this time last year, so a lot later in coming than planned. Apologies to Laurie for the delay, so sorry. It was a lovely relaxed chat in our secret London location, with a creaky chair and guest cats joining us. It might be a little roomy, but otherwise it's a clear recording, and it's full of jovial atmosphere. There are a host of links to plays and pods in the show description to follow up with, but till then, it's over to past Robert to chat away.
Hello and welcome to this discussing episode. As you can hear by the sound that we are in a very convivial kitchen. There are some cats in the background. I have a slightly creaky chair. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and we are going to be chatting about playing companies, specifically Leicester's Men, with my wonderful guest who has written a book all about such things. So, my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, Robert. Thank you for having me. I'm Laurie Johnson. And my current purpose is to try and learn as much as I can, or we can, about early playing companies, early playhouses, and what that tells us about early plays.
Excellent. So, Leicester's Men, we are talking about the... Oh, God, there's so many traps I could fall into here in doing this.
That's okay. I think it's a good idea to fall into a trap.
I think I can open the trap up again. I have a number of straw men ready for burning that we can go into. But we're talking primarily at the very beginning of Elizabeth's reign. There is an overlap with what's happening before. There is a world of playing that has existed in different fashions over the last 100 years or so. We're in a world where there are still a certain amount of mystery playing going on. A religious drama is still technically extant, despite various ordinances saying don't talk about God, but reiterated by various monarchs. But most playing companies that are on the borders of being what we might call professional, and again, we've got to be a bit careful to talking about amateur versus professional because there's a lot of overlap. So we have a world where there are a reasonable number of relatively small companies, and within this maelstrom of things, we have Leicester's Men.
Yeah.
Where do they come from? Who are they?
Well, that's the initial straw man that I was first grappling with, and I honestly thought it wasn't a straw man. I honestly thought I would find enough evidence to support the age-old assumption that they were formed from within Leicester's own household. Although I should have seen the fairly obvious piece of evidence against that, which is that when they write to the same patron in 1572, they've been around by that stage for 13 to 14 years, and presumably in response to the Vagabond Act and some of its manifestations, they write to Leicester and say, we would love if you could actually allow us to be labelled members of your household, which would suggest, of course, that they weren't members of the household, but they would have had to have been if they were formed from within. So the question is, of where did they come from? Clearly not from within Leicester's own household to begin with. So the question then had to be, well, how can we know where they come from? And there are a number of various research techniques, one of which is opened up more recently with all the old parish records being digitized and being made available, at least in some rudimentary form, on ancestry.com. For the small price of a subscription to that service, one can then plow through those and find the early players. And it turns out that they were all living in London, as it so happens, around the time that the company was formed as Leicester's Men. My belief is that there's enough evidence to suggest that they were already a company, but not yet Leicester's Men. But they don't appear on the record until they become, or at least he becomes their patron, as Robert Dudley at the time.
Yes, because we have this sort of problem with playing companies, is that in a sense that there is no genesis for playing companies, in the sense that most playing companies are built on the ashes of a previous playing company, that there are personnel who are always transferring, who may already bring with them some sort of repertoire of plays that they already know. So to say these people start at this point is often very difficult to assess, because they may, some of them may have come from somewhere slightly earlier, especially at a time where the idea of being a professional player is, you know, even the term player is not necessarily extant at this point, certainly not commonplace.
That's right.
At this point. So, yeah, trying to assess the creation of a company when it may come from bits of others is quite difficult. And I'm right in saying that you start with biography in terms of a way of narrowing down what's going on.
That's right. And so the initial step was to take an activity that Bill Ingram was basically the first to sort of popularise. I mean, there'd been dictionaries of actors going back 140 years or so, but they usually had very light on for biographical details. Bill's work in the book The Business of Playing from around 30 years ago was the first moment when a scholar started saying, let's look at a player and start to map out as much as we can of that player's life. And that will tell us a little bit more about the profession of playing, to use that word again, to imagine of them as professionals, rather than just the company as a professional, but each player as a professional. What were the stresses in their life? Who were the people they knew? Who were the people they trusted with their business associations and so on? That playing was, as Bill said, a business. Now, of course, he didn't then map that onto companies as such. He didn't sort of map out full biographies of as many members of a given company that he could. But it seemed to me that it was what was missing from many of the company histories that I'd been reading, people whose work I love and was trying to model my own study on. But nevertheless, it was the missing gap to say, if we really want to understand this company and the pressures that they have to respond to collectively, we need to understand them also as a collection of individuals.
Mm.
As it turns out, though, the more you dig into the parish records and the records of housing and so on, and you figure out where they were living and who they married and who were their cousins and sisters and brothers and so on, turns out that the players actually formed very close familial relationships, at least in that early stage.
Mm.
I think they start to get a little bit more kind of drawn out as the genealogies become more scattered across time. But in that early period, early Elizabethan period at least anyway, it seemed that the Leicester's men were an example of one company that was very close-knit, very tightly drawn together by familial connections, parochial connections, and the company connection, business connection.
Mm. So they're not, initially, they're not formed as part of a household. Mm-hmm. So they don't necessarily have the resources that a household brings, in the sense that a household will often have lots of accoutrements, costumes, props, things that you can nab, places you can rehearse, all those practical things about creating a theatre company. So what do they have to make shows happen? Where are they based? Where are they performing?
That's a good question.
Some of which can be, we don't know.
That's it. Where exactly they're performing in London, we don't know, because the records for their sort of week-by-week running don't really attach themselves to a location at that time. We don't have Henslowe's records, for example, until 1591 and onwards. So for the 1560s and so on, there seems to be more simply evidence from what Chambers once labelled documents of control, the regulatory documents that refer to players having been performing in a location where performing was supposedly prohibited. And you then say, okay, well, that's probably the players are also the same players who were evidently touring as a company, and yet also, I can imagine, had to have been performing in London. Where they do pop up, of course, on the radar in the records, and therefore we know they must have been playing around London, was because they perform at court. Elizabeth starts court revels from a very early part of her reign, from 1560 onwards. We get year-by-year accounts, and the early accounts are actually far more substantial and detailed than the late 1570s and onwards records. The early record keepers, the masters of revels, and their clerks in the initial days are very meticulous in recording what companies were performing, what plays they performed, what props they required, who was paid for the manufacture of those props, and so on.
Mm.
Now, of course, we have to imagine they can't just then pick up and take those props with them.
Mm.
But around the 1570s, the business model at court changes, and you get, I think it was Thomas Blagrave was the first to do this. He says, actually, no, if you want to perform at court, companies, you need to bring your own props and costumes.
Mm.
And we'll provide you with a few of the basic essentials. You get some nice gloves and so on out of us.
Yeah.
And that's all that appears. So we know somewhere along the way, companies had to be recognizing that they, if they want to put on plays for the public that nevertheless were draw cards because the Queen had seen them, they had to in some way approximate what had been on the stage at court.
Mm.
And so they must have been producing scenery, costumes, etc., through various connections with manufacturers of various kinds, various crafts and guildsmen, or they themselves were crafts and guildsmen as well. They were members of guilds, joiners and leather makers and so on.
Mm. And there is quite a shift in Elizabeth's early reign, whereas we're sort of covering what you've already said, but in the sense that a lot of the rebels were in-house initially. There's an awful lot of money is being spent, and Elizabeth doesn't like spending money.
Exactly right.
And so there is a shift there from everything coming from the rebels' office. Lots of stuff in stock, and they do keep stock going forward, and they will hire out their stock going forward. But it's mostly coming from the rebels' office. Whereas as time goes on, everything is effectively outsourced to these playing companies that are becoming more established and more professional. Is that all fair?
That is. There is one spanner in the works, and it's a work that I think hasn't been given its due. An article or a couple of articles by John Koldewey about the existence of a type called the property player from the 1530s and 1540s, most of whom were stationed outside London. Except there was one, it turns out, that happens to be living in the same parish that the early Leicester's Men members were involved in. And I think there's a kind of a connection that has to be insinuated there. Right. I can't prove it, but I think it's at least a fairly good connection possibility. If you're a player and there's a property player in your vicinity, you're probably going to be using your services. And what's a property player, I hear you ask?
Yes. I've got it noted down in my notes. It was something I was very interested in when I was reading your book.
It's like a prototype of what becomes the Philip Henslow theatre entrepreneur, just sans playhouse. So they are in charge of props. They can be agents for players. They can even make bookings for whole companies. So they're managers, in a sense, of players, but without a specific single company that they oversee the responsibility for. And we know that these people were trading in costumes and props from a very early stage, 1530s and 1540s, a lot of this business shows up in the records. And there are lawsuits between the property players and owners of properties, that is, of actual property, land or houses or estates and so on, that they put on a play and they damaged the house, or they used some of the clothing from that person's wardrobe and yet then they got torn or badly treated and so on. Mm. This all happens before, when wisdom has told us that kind of the modern professional playing companies emerge, which is presumably around 1580s, 1590s, but something like a business of playing was clearly going on in the 1530s and 1540s.
I'm thinking that this feels like it's an extension and a logical crossover from... We do know that in the medieval period that... mystery playing, they will occasionally hire, people who are on the borders of maybe calling themselves professional actors. Yeah. But there are storehouses that are effectively hiring out costumes and props and materials. And once the Reformation happens and that established market gets undermined, and mystery plays don't just disappear, it takes a long time for, shall we say, the checks of incentives and disincentives to draw more on the disincentive side. And during Elizabeth's reign, the disincentives will just keep increasing. That maybe these established networks drift into a more professional level of we're going to put on our own or organise productions in a slightly more separate way. So there is something going on there And that's a significant timing for that, that it's just after the Reformation starts really kicking
that's right.
in.
And it's soon after the property players, 1530s, 1540s, we also get records in guild halls within London, professional guilds. A number of them have records of players hiring their hall rather than the other way around. David Catman wrote a wonderful article on this, which kind of sets the flag, if you like, in the ground for when does something like professional company practice begin. It's the moment they recognize the need to have a venue themselves rather than just being on beck and call for anyone else who needs their services. That's professionalization starts to kick in and they start recognizing the need therefore. And it's from that, I think, you can then see the eventual pressure emerging economically to say, rather than hiring other venues, we should just build our own.
Yes. Which I suppose leads us to the Red Lion.
Yeah.
So we're in the 1560s. Leicester's men seem to be established initially in London. They're doing some touring.
Absolutely.
But also by 1567, the Red Lion project appears. So what do we think of the forces leading to all those things? So yes, the idea of having a permanent or semi-permanent space for performing, but also potentially just for storage. Well, we're talking about
absolutely
things.
Right. When you've got things and you acquire those things, you need to keep them somewhere. Mm. And if it may as well be there for the same building in which you're actually going to be able to house your performances.
Mm.
House your performances and your performance material all in the one place. It's a lot less pressure on anyone else in your business networks to have to store material for you. And less concern for you as a company that your assets are therefore at the whim of someone else who might on-sell them. Mm. Go back to those law cases when it comes to lawsuits involving property players, there were issues with property players on-selling costumes that they had apparently hired. But it's important to remember when we talk about the Red Lion to make sure that the listeners are aware that the Red Lion has been found. The University College of London Archaeology Southeast team, led by Steve White, found it a few years ago. If you Google Red Lion excavation or archaeology, you'll find the occasional bits of news about it. I was very lucky that Steve and the team were happy to share with me the results while I was working on the Leicester's Men project, because up until it had been found, there was received wisdom that because the only documentary evidence we had of its existence previously was a court case based on the stability or otherwise of the scaffolding representing the stage and some of the gallery, that it was only ever a very temporary structure meant for just one or two performances. If it was for one, it was of a play called Story of Samson. If it was for more, then it was an assumed that Samson kind of being the only play that they were going to be performing. But nevertheless, the idea had for a very long time become standard knowledge that the Red Lion was a temporary structure. Well, Steve White's team pointed out that no, it was very much a very large permanent structure or semi-permanent structure that also then went through several series of conversion to other purposes, including potentially animal baiting in a later iteration of its use. That the Red Lion, in other words, is very much that sense of they're looking for a semi-permanent playhouse, not just, oh, we want to do one or two, a one-off performance of a thing called Story of Samson, let's build a scaffold. So that there's the reason, I think, therefore, that it only appears in the documentary record as a result of a law case around the scaffold is because that's the one bit that got wrong. The rest of the building was very stable and very well structured and so on. And so they didn't see the need to sue anyone for bad workmanship.
This is the perennial problem for all of what we're talking about here is that there are actually so few bits of documentation that we can actually work from.
Yeah.
We are not talking, I mean, we haven't even got onto the plays that they perform, but you know, we have very few confirmable texts and arguably almost none. There's very little data that we can very firmly grab onto, but it's a matter of trying to mesh so many different sources together and build a sensible path through.
But what I think we can now say fairly confidently is that 1576, and the theatre is no longer the benchmark for when was the first semi-permanent playhouse constructed.
Yeah.
Clearly 1567 is at least another starting point. There may have been others before then. I don't know for certain, but we know, therefore, 1567 has to be a newer starting point.
And they are not unconnected structures as well.
That's right.
So the Red Lion and the later theatre share personnel with interests.
That's right. That's right. James Burbage and John Brain would seem to have been involved in both. John Brain was certainly involved in both. John Brain being James Burbage's, let me get this right, father-in-law, or brother-in-law. I always get that one wrong. I skip a generation somewhere in my thinking. The point is, Margaret Brain is married to James Burbage, and so the Brain connection to the Burbages is established there. And they go in cahoots together on the theatre. That's well established because they also later fought like cat and dog over that same location, which is why we have such a wealth of legal cases over that structure. John Brain, however, is the only one that appears in the documentary record because he's the one that sued the construction over the scaffold, which I think suggests that he just happened to be the one. It was his money investing in that part of the building. Burbage. It would seem to suggest that the fact that they're so closely related and they later had that big partnership, that they probably were in cahoots together over the Red Lion's construction. And who's James Burbage, of course? He's the head of Leicester's Men. From the earliest documentary evidence we have of the company's existence, he shows up as the first guy named, not just because it's alphabetical, but there seems to be a hierarchy in the company personnel, and every time their names are on documents together.
So they initially appear and they appear to be playing in London. They are they go on tour,
yeah,
in various different ways over time. And this is over time,
yeah,
as well. This is one of the issues that we're getting across. We're talking a 30-year span here. We're still very much in the first decade. We're still in the first decade.
We can skip forward.
But in terms of in that, while we're still in the early period, how many people are in Leicester's Men to start with, as opposed to where they will eventually end up?
Somewhere between 4 and 6,
which is not unusual for the
time. No, that's right. In fact, at the time, most companies are in that 4 to 6 bracket. 5 appears to be a fairly solid regular number that a lot of companies are using, but occasionally a change in personnel might occur over someone dying and 2 people being brought in to replace or so on. Yeah.
And we don't really know in that first decade very much about what they might be playing per se.
Except what they get at court, thanks to those court records. We know that their repertory, as we would now call it, but I think I kind of deal with the idea more of there being a sort of just a stockpile of plays, a playing stock, if you like.
Yes. You know, they have a repertoire, but they're not necessarily performing in repertory.
That's exactly right.
I mean, how often are a group like this playing? I mean, people think of the later playhouses where you know, they're performing a different play every day and rotating that round. How often is a small group like that needing to perform to stay in business?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't have a lot of hard data. There is a lovely piece of evidence around Trinity Church Hall, just outside of London on the Smithfield Market Way. There's a hall up there that has records of playing companies hiring it. It's one of the ones that David Catman actually doesn't talk about. It follows, because it's much later period, it's in the 1560s that this is happening. And there's companies hiring it, and it's clear that there are more than one company hiring it. My gut feeling is that if companies are hiring, then Leicester's Men are going to be one of those companies hiring a venue. But then there is one year when suddenly the number ramps up. Normally, companies are hiring it for 1 or 2 performances in any given season, so to speak, any given year in the accounts. But then in right near the tail end, there's a really big run where I think it's something like 20 or 30 plays, depending on how much is being paid for particular use of the venue. It almost seems as though it's one company hiring the hall for an extended run, which would suggest they must have multiple plays. of course, these days we would think nothing of a single player running for 20 or 30 weeks, but...
Population scale and disposable income is slightly different.
That's right. Yes, not everyone's going to keep coming back to see the same player over and over again. So there's a very strong suggestion at that moment that, at the very least, even if it's multiple companies using it, you're probably dealing with 10 to 12 performances by each company that use it, or more if there are fewer companies. And that's just before the Red Lion gets built. So that kind of speaks to a company recognizing that we're not going to keep hiring this hall. If we're going to put on that many performances, we need to build our own venue, which makes it a viable economic, at least, investment.
And there is a difference between if you're performing in one location, how many plays you're going to perform, as opposed to going on tour, when you only maybe need two or three options.
Exactly right.
Depending on which tour route you're going through. So when they're on tour, why are they going on tour, and when? Obviously, this is more spread out conversation,
I think. At the very beginning of their existence, here I speak back to Bill Ingram, who wrote a wonderful essay on John Dudley's players. So Robert Dudley's father had his own playing company, and for a little period in time, when his own political career was at a kind of tipping point, suddenly he gets a playing company and they go on the road. And Ingram uses the phrase standard bearers, that they're out there to basically win the hearts and minds of the population in support of the guy who wants to be Lord Protector. Flash forward to Robert Dudley. He's been through the family having been disgraced, and then suddenly they regain their privileges, and he decides, I need a company to be standard bearer if I'm to win back the population who will have lost faith in me as a result of my family having been disgraced. So the players then are on the road to tour to serve the interests of their patron. So he says, right, I want to be looking at some property up there in Yorkshire. I want you to go and perform there. I'm going to be acquiring interests in Norfolk. Go and perform in Norwich. And that seems to be a sound understanding for why they tour and why they tour when and where they do. But then they also need to be able to maintain economic viability while they're on the road. And so I think there's this kind of a little bit of one, a little bit of the other, a little bit doing what their lord and master needs, a little bit being self-sufficient. In the meantime, so long as you hit these points, in between those places, if you want to perform at any other locations, go for your selves and live it up.
Yes. Side hustles, actors. That's right. I use them. And because I was thinking in those very early days, it might be that they're not performing all the time. They have other jobs that they're just doing.
Absolutely. That guildsman kind of background that they have is that, again, David Catton's the guru on this one, having written about the guild identities of a whole number of people. We knew James Burbage was a joiner, which probably had some aspect of him being involved in the construction of the playhouses then. But others were grocers and drapers and leather makers and so on. And it's pretty clear that they sometimes, even if a whole year would go by without either touring or performing at court or performing in London, there's a good chance that they were also just plying their trade.
So, like many actors today. Just
ever was it thus?
Yes. We're moving ahead in time when everything gets so much more busy and crowded and more money is being turned over in larger spaces. That's when we can say that this awkward distinction between amateur and professional, arguably professional in terms of what they're doing as a professional product, but they may have other side jobs going on, as opposed to, say, the person who's primarily does a job and then occasionally does some acting.
We do in the parish records, for those parishes that do us the great service of recording the vocation or profession or guild identity of an individual parishioner, a clear sense of when the word player starts getting accepted as relevant. And it's in the 1560s that we start to see player appear, except if someone is previously a member of the King's Men. They will be listed as so-and-so of the King's Majesty's service and so on. But player will start appearing alongside individuals in the parish records in around the 1560s. So it's becoming acceptable. and identify it as a profession in its own right.
Yes, and it's interesting that the play Jack Juggler, in its earliest printing, the players, they're called actors.
Yeah.
And then in a later printing, it is changed to player. So it is a term that at this point is starting to develop.
Absolutely.
And have some cachet and some meaning in that sense. So, as we drift into the 1570s, mm-hmm. they've been at the Red Lion. How long does that necessarily last for them?
It's a good question. We've only just had to sort of reposition our thinking around the fact that the building lasted more than just a couple of weeks or mm-hmm. even a couple of months, and that it was clearly still in use for some time afterwards. I think just lining up a range of things that happen and who they happened to, it would make sense to think that the Red Lion was still available for use past 1576, but the company itself had long accepted that the right location for them was in Shoreditch at the Theatre and the Curtain. But I think there's a moment in the late 1570s, early 1580s, when Burbage cuts ties with the company that he was formerly a head of. He seems to have decided at that moment that his primary investment and proprietary interests are in the theatre and the Curtain, and that the company can go and fend for themselves. And they cut ties at around about late 1570s, around 1580. And then the company start appearing elsewhere, but we don't have them associated with another playhouse. And so I think it's possible they could have even been back at the Red Lion in that late 1570s to early 1580 period. And it's soon afterwards, then the Rose and a number of other playhouses start emerging in the late 1580s. And so it's difficult to pin down a company with a playhouse, except that we know Leicester's men were not in Henslowe's records.
Yes.
Except if you accept that Strang's men, or Strange's men, however you want to pronounce it, were the next iteration of Leicester's men,
yes.
They do appear in Henslowe.
Yes, but we may be getting ahead of ourselves.
That's right.
So, 1570s. So, we were saying they're starting off with a relatively small company size, moving up to perhaps about seven in the company.
Except for a little period when suddenly they seem to go berserk and tour with about 12 men in 1 year. And I come up with a bit of a theory as to how they could have populated a company of 12 at that moment. And it's to do with the plays themselves. The plays start increasing in complexity, and doubling is starting to get a little bit confusing, trying to do it snap, snap, snap very quickly.
Yeah.
Suddenly you only have 14 lines to change costumes.
Yeah. So what sort of plays that survive do we think they might have been playing?
Well, in the early days, I think that we're looking at plays that, based on other people's work, I didn't necessarily have to do too much legwork myself in trying to identify which plays, and this is because plays that they performed at court, or some wonderful work done by Paul Whitfield White saying that here's, we've got William Wager, the playwright, having vested interests in getting preferments and roles that Lord Leicester himself would have been the one most likely to have been responsible for appointing, which would then line Wager's plays up with the company. And to me, they do speak to a kind of consistency in terms of what personnel they've got, what types of characters they were they be performing, how does that map onto what they were performing at court. And we're dealing with what you call proverbial plays there, plays that seem to have a moral message. And sorry for listeners, I've just become distracted by a friendly feline.
Yes, Mystery has joined us for very interested in Wager as a playwright of whom we have potentially 3.5 plays available, all of which you can sample as exploring sessions on the podcast at time of recording, and sometime in the future you may even be able to listen to full cast audio adaptations thereof. Apart from possibly. No, I haven't done that one yet. It's a fragment session. Yes, they are available on some form. Links will be in the show description.
So in addition to the Wager plays, the sort of proverbials, we also have plays that focus on a common figure, the peddler or the cobbler or the seamstress. That's not quite the right word for the era, is it? Seamstress. Gamma Gurton's needle, for example, that the company seems to be focusing on either proverbials or commoners or plays that form a combination of both. I think that's partly to do with who their audience is. They need to be showing the monarch that they can put on a good Protestant morality story without necessarily being overly religious about it. But at the same time, they also want to have those same plays speaking a language that is recognisable for its audiences, who are more commoners and workers themselves.
So, yes, we have the sort of nucleus of some text that we might be able to actually examine and play with.
Yeah.
Gamma Gurton's Needle, there is a full cast audio adaptation available on the podcast as well. just, you know, useful things for our listeners to be able to engage with. I mean, generally, it's very difficult to associate plays with any playing company at this time, because so few survive. 1570s particularly is this empty period where publishing is not so interested in in drama. In many ways, there's a fair amount before, and that's possibly because you can sort of link it to moral themes and you can read it as a text for some level of instruction. But as genres shift and what you're allowed to perform in terms of religious drama shifts, the print market doesn't seem to be very interested or doesn't know what to do with it. And there will be a change later on, but unfortunately outside of Leicester's existence, which is very frustrating.
That's right. It's the sort of the gap decade, if you like, in records of companies, because unfortunately, at around the same time that Blagrave and subsequent masters lose interest in providing all the props and material for companies, they also lose interest in precisely what plays they're putting on. And so you get a number of years in which it's merely mentioned that this or that company was paid for their service, but not what they performed. So in addition to there being lost plays for which we have a title, there are also now plays that we know they were performed, we just don't know what play it was.
And you're sifting through evidence from, as you mentioned, titles of plays and trying to figure out what they might be about, but also inferring from props that
have not
been assigned to any other text or any other activity.
That's the thing. There's been a fair bit of work done, but it's all very piecemeal. And Martin Wiggins and Catherine Richardson for the British Drama Catalogue have done remarkable work, and they're undoubtedly Vasti support research teams, going through all the various court records, all the various eyewitness accounts, and of course the extant texts of surviving texts themselves to say what props were needed for these plays. And if you then go to the records themselves, however, you'll find that there are props that are listed that haven't been assigned to a play by the catalogue. And so you have to start thinking, okay, if there's a company that performed a play that wasn't given a name, Leicester's Men played this year, but we don't have their play, whereas we have the five plays performed by other companies, then you can say, okay, these props that haven't been assigned to extant plays probably were part of Leicester's Men's play. And so you can then try and figure out what storyline could have needed all of those plays. So you start looking at the stories of Bundello and various other narrative sources that were used for plays at the time. We're told this by Stephen Gosson and other anti-theatricalists that...
Stephen Gosson,
the font of all.
Poacher turned gamekeeper, I think.
Exactly right.
He was a playwright and then he wrote some very long tracts.
That's right.
Which I have been meaning to do more on, but they're very long.
And so even as he's confessing to having written plays of one degree of excellence or other, he also, of course, is pointing out the problems with the playhouses. But in so doing, he's also giving us a wonderful little catalogue of who are the various authors of antiquity and more recent time that have been informing the playwrights in their plays. And you then say, oh, well, here's a play that needs a chimney and a chimney sweep. And there's a story about a collier who is hiding in a chimney. That's probably the play that they would have been performing there. It's not the collier play that we know, or the collier plays that we know. There are more than one, but it's probably a bit of a prototype for those plays, or a prototype for the collier figure. Yeah.
Yes, that there will be sort of stock trope figures that dance through various people's works, either through emulation or just because it's the same writer or the same actor. I'll do a very good Collier. can you make sure you put Absolutely. One in? It always goes down well with the audience until it doesn't. So we drift into the 1580s, the latter years of the company. The company does have a very definite end point. Mm-hmm. But we've got quite a confused situation in the 1580s in terms of Leicester's commitments for them make running a theatre company quite complicated.
That's right. They've just started to expand into the early 1580s, and the expansion in question would seem to be mirrored by the construction or the formation of the Queen's Men.
So the Queen's Men being the supergroup that created the dirty dozen of the playing world mm-hmm. were plucked from different companies.
That's right. And we receive wisdom says that there's probably three or four that come from Leicester's. I think we can extend that number. Once I did some of that other work by looking at what players had family connections to which players, potentially therefore suggesting a couple of other members of Queen's Men that probably had previously been in Leicester's Men at that period. So it's possibly as much as half of Leicester's Men get cannibalised into the Queen's Men, and it's going to take them a little bit of time to rebuild from that. And just as they're rebuilding from that, so that was in 1583 that the Queen's Men were formed. In 1585, Leicester decides he's going to go and take this great diplomatic campaign into Europe to try and put, how shall we say this, the Queen's imprimatur on various Catholic versus Protestant flashpoints around Northern Europe. And he takes, as part of that diplomatic campaign, a very large entourage of performers, at least 12 of whom were players. How many of those were actually members of his own company? It's not quite easy to tell, but there are a few bits where we have records of players that we know were in the company being on that tour. They have items bought for them. They must have had a coat rip or something as they get a new piece of apparel bought for them. And then, however, he decides magnanimously to gift half a dozen of them to King Frederick of Denmark. And so for several weeks they're in Elsinore performing in his service. And there are records in which he writes to Christian, his son, to say, paraphrasing, "I can't bear the upkeep of these guys. Here, you have them." And so they then go to serve in Saxony for the next, and it's the better part of 8 to 9 months that they're over there. So for almost a year, they're out of service from the company back in England. Mm. And so what Leicester's Men look like as a company, circa 1583 through to 1586, for example, or even into 87, the numbers are very difficult to make out because we only know who were no longer in the company. Mm. Some people have determined that means that they must have folded, that they can't have possibly continued to exist as a touring company in England. And yet we do have records of them touring throughout that period. In fact, during the period when they presumably would have had no one to perform for them, save for Will Kemp, who gets back early, the great clown Will Kemp, they go on the most ambitious tour you could imagine in 1587. We've got more than sort of 20 points that they've visited all across the country. What used to be separate circuits, they all weave together in one giant tour. It's massive, and it's difficult to imagine how big that company must have been, except to say, okay, by subtraction from who we know was in the company at that time, and then at the end, we're probably looking at about four people going on tour again in 1587.
And if we look at the kind of repertoire, there was a repertoire of, you know, plays of you know, four or so actors, which is doable, but you have the thought that maybe they're doing something else either on top of or entirely separately.
Well, the great innovation that we associate with Will Kemp is the jig, which for many people has often been thought of as simply the dance entertainment that you'd put on at the end of a dramatic entertainment. You've done your 2 hours traffic on the stage, you still have a half an hour of sunlight, quick, put on a jig, and everyone's really happy. That this is something we associate with Kemp. And I think if we backtrack to what's happening in 1587, when you've got the company obliterated in terms of its membership, and he needs to come up with something that can be performed, entertaining, popular, but with minimal company personnel buy-in, then the Jig seems to be a perfect kind of innovation for that. And we do have that they were set piece plays as well. It's not just that they were random dances put on at the end of plays, that the Jig of singing Simpkin and so on and so forth. We know that these were enrolling and so on.
Yes, and again, you can. There are links to the, some Roll of our Dungeon reads. Yes. We have read through the text. We haven't done music or dance with them. But in the sense that they are plays, they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They have a narrative structure that is told through song and dance and maybe even speech as well. It's a question of actually how much of those texts survive. And so in that sense, they might be touring quite an elaborate show of an indeterminate length. Mm-hmm. And that what they could be touring, they might have some dramatic fare, so maybe some older dramatic fare that's only requires four actors or so. And then a jig that could potentially be quite long.
And it could be the showpiece. Instead of a playbill for a play, which may feature a jig, you have a playbill for a jig that may feature some other entertainments as well. A bit of combat and a bit of other kinds of show.
Well, also we know tumbling. That when you've got a clown in on your bill, that they can improvise and react to what the audience is doing. We know that Tartan, for example, would take things from the audience and then throw it back at them, extempore, and do that. So this reads more like a variety act than dramatic action, which is not a criticism. I think that idea is actually quite delightful because it suggests that potentially other people may also be doing that before or after, and that is part of the mix.
And I think what it also does, I probably didn't do enough of a job of trying to make this point in the book. It's sort of it's an idea that's formed more strongly in my mind subsequently, that we have to abandon the idea of a kind of straight teleology that goes from the medieval morality plays to the court performances to the professional performances, and that when they go on tour, they're always taking a play, a touring version of a much longer play, etc., that the history is going to be more bumpy and rocky, and they'll get the moments when very successful companies will be trying things that later don't continue. And I think the Jig at that moment later becomes the add-on for plays, simply because it's not viable when the company reforms, when those guys come back from service in Saxony and suddenly you've got a big company again. It seems then that's the moment for the Jig to just be appended. And for other companies who are already larger in personnel, it wasn't a particularly attractive proposition to be performing Jigs as their primary showpiece around a kind of variety act performance. And we get that sense, therefore, that we have to not imagine that it's a straightforward evolution, that there are moments of flashpoints of innovation that will lead to dead ends.
Well, I think that connects now with our more modern idea of evolution, which is that people will go off and move in one direction and then they'll come back and re-encounter a separate gene pool and have fun times, and different forms will emerge out of that. The evolution itself isn't particularly linear.
That's right.
And again, we're mentioning what survives in print is what survives in print sometimes then gets a re-emerge or inspires someone much later on. And so that we haven't even got to the idea of nostalgia yet. This was a thing that happened ages ago. Maybe elements of that will be something that people actually appeals to people. I mean, we're at the very early stages of that kind of thing with this group.
I have to admit that there were temptations to try and assign to Lester's Men plays that I know were around in the late 1580s, while they were still around, prior to their definite endpoint, as you pointed out, which of course is the death of the Earl of Leicester himself, but which hadn't yet been confidently assigned to any other company because of that messiness we have of knowing precise. And Spanish Tragedy was one of those. It's clearly a 1587 play. It's often been written about that it can't have been 1588 later because it doesn't mention the Spanish Armada. And the temptation to say, oh, if it isn't anyone else's, could it possibly be Lester's Men? No, I found no evidence whatsoever to allow it to fit the narrative that I was able to piece together from all the other evidence that I was compiling. That was going to be one step too far. And I'll admit, even Gamma, Gurton, and Needle is a long shot.
Mm.
It's based on a very small amount of evidence, and it's very, very big speculation that I sort of throw out there.
And I think with a text like Gamma, Gurton, and Needle, again, partly because it's in print, is that everybody could be doing it, actually.
That's right.
And so it's just as reasonable to say that. But it does fit in the sort of shape of Lesterman having a sort of a relatively small nucleus that can expand and contract,
yeah,
but is not leaping to the scales that we get in the with Lord Strange's and those later companies, where the scale of the operation seems bigger,
yeah,
and the ambition is perhaps bigger in terms of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and it ultimately was a case of it seems to fit the bill of a play that had not yet been assigned to any other company. We know that Lester's were in Cambridge at around the time that the play was said to have been performed,
mm-hmm,
subsequently.
Yes.
Gamma,
Gurton, and Needle has a lengthy potential performance history going back exactly considerably right. further from when it was first printed.
That's exactly right. But we kind of latch it in there and I say, okay, well, it suits the kind of play that they were performing, as you say, in terms of scale, ambition, but also focal point around working class people. But nevertheless having a kind of moral attached to it as well.
Mm.
I think a fairly heavily Protestant one attached to it in that respect.
Mm. So, Lester's men, they're on tour, their patron dies, it takes them a while to notice.
Absolutely. For a good...
Shouldn't laugh. cut down on his pride.
For a good month to 2 months, they're still on tour. They don't get the word, or even if they do get the word, they're not splitting from their tour. They're going to keep going. And they don't know what else to call themselves, obviously, if they do know that he's dead, or the chances are that they don't know that he's dead. Even after Lester dies, there's a moment, I think from memory it's in Norwich, where the players are recorded as having had a bit of a set-to with one of the locals. And in the legal documentation within the town, the council records and the local sheriff's report, etc., they're just constantly referred to as Lester's players. There's no sense for those people that Lester's dead either. So the word hasn't yet got around.
Mm.
And this is several weeks after he's dead. So it takes a while for news to carry at this time.
And I suppose they may even have an incentive not to tell anyone. Because, of course, you know, it's quite important to be able to get through the door to be able to say, we are X person's men.
And not only to get through the door, the license that carries just to even get through the door, absolutely. But as Lester's men, they were, for a long period of time, on the second rung, or occasionally the top rung, of payment rates.
Mm.
People aren't aware necessarily, unless they drill through the Reed records exhaustively, suddenly realise that Queen's men were routinely paid 40 shillings a performance for their command performance in a given town. Leicester's men and other second-tier companies, and there weren't too many of them, were paid 20 shillings.
Mm.
Occasionally, when Queen's men drop off in popularity and importance, Leicester's men join them on the top tier, around 20 to 30 shillings. That, I must tell you as well, listeners, is lower for some towns that can't afford that rate.
Yeah.
How they worked out these rates seems to have been based on what the capital was in a given town, but they are consistent. If you're the Queen's men, you are consistently being paid in any given town twice what Leicester's men or other second-tier companies are, and then there are third and fourth-tiers companies below them that are paid lower rates again until you get some that are paid just a couple of shillings to perform in any given town. And that's what Leicester's men's license carries, not just to get in the door, but that payment rate. It assures them that extra rate.
So their patron's gone, and they presumably either need to find a new patron or they disperse and find other work as individuals. And in that sense, what happens to that company?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
This is the ultimate problem with company studies, in the sense of, you know, where do we put the continuity points? Where do we say this is essentially a continuing franchise as opposed to orphans in a storm?
In an earlier book writing about Lord Chamberlain's men, I point out that their first appearance, the appearance in Newington Butts, appears to be on the back end of a Derby's men, Strange's men's tour. Which would suggest that when he dies while they're on tour, they get word before they get into London, but they are quickly assigned to the Lord Chamberlain, why they become that company at that moment, not the duopoly theory that has been propagated by a number of significant scholars. But nevertheless, there we can kind of track a certain kind of momentum. Here we have another company that loses its patron while they're still on tour, but it's clear they haven't yet been able to identify or be assigned to another one. And yet there is, and has been for some time, a fairly common perception that the same players became strangers' men, that basically Stanley just said, look, I'll become your patron. But where and when that happened, that's difficult to pin down. So it's possible that apparent continuity nevertheless must overcome a speed bump when they have to get into town to get back to London to identify a particular patron. And who that's going to be, they've got to aim high, but they probably can't aim too high. Of course, Lester's funeral actually provides us a bit of a clue in terms of who did and who did not attend. Mm. There's a whole bunch of people of significant importance, Queen herself, for example, who go and attend. There's a whole bunch of people who didn't, and Strange is one who didn't. And so there's a good chance that basically they just decided to shop around in London for another viable patron of significant standing. But that's speculation. It just seems to fit with who was around and who wasn't, and then that their continuity of personnel show up again in Strange's. But there's also another line of thinking that they may have become Pembroke's men, or that it's Strange's / Darby's, then Pembroke's, then back to Darby's again, and kind of goes on all over the place. But one thing that they do become is a significant number of the personnel do eventually become Lord Chamberlain's men. They become part of that line of inheritance that we can trace straight towards Shakespeare. I know, but what I can tell you is, of course, I do find no evidence whatsoever to suggest that the S was in Earl of Leicester's men. The timing just doesn't line up. And so as a result, while some people have argued that he went off with them or with the Queen's men or whatever in 87 or 88 from Stratford, there's just no evidence for that whatsoever. It doesn't line up with the company personnel that we know. So by talking about Leicester's men, we are still beyond that guy.
and it is that sense. So you know, that some of the personnel end up in, but there is a sort of difficult middle period of figuring out. And of course, because we don't really know what their repertoire was in terms of where that then ends up, isn't necessarily much of a clue either. Because of course, if the company effectively breaks up, they'll have stuff that needs to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And who does it go with? And I don't get the impression that there's that sort of continuity of either repertoire, or it may just is that the personnel go on, but wherever they go, they're doing something quite different.
And I think it's because the repertory that they established by the end of 87, 88, Kemp's Jigs, etc., and then whatever plays they're able to piece together from their former repertory or repertoire, by this stage I think they're doing repertory. Nevertheless, it's already old material.
Yeah.
They're just reviving stuff that they had before a whole bunch of the company were sent away. And so by that stage then, in their next iteration, they're having to come up with some new material because already it's old hat.
Yeah.
They can't just keep reviving this.
And the material they've got doesn't necessarily fit the size of the company they're entering So they have to fill somebody else's pot rather than their pot filling being filled by the other company.
And that's an important point, actually, is that Strange's men do exist before 1588.
Yeah.
So there clearly is a company that Lord Strange has at that time that these other guys, even if it's not the entire group, do join with. So the question of it just simply being another patron, I think that's kind of, we have to disband that idea.
And the, you know, Lord Strange, Strang, their repertoire is on a scale. I mean, there seems to be an ambition there.
Yeah.
That I don't see that kind of continuity of repertoire. I can see them coming and say, yeah, you're playing this part, mate. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And that's how they might get absorbed in that sense. But the idea of the jigs going on, I think that is one of their most important legacy, actually.
Yeah, it becomes part of the landscape of subsequent entertainments around the playhouses, yeah.
So, all of this is detailed in a book of whose title I haven't even mentioned in this recording so far. So, official plug time for your book.
Yep. It's Leicester's Men and Their Plays, an early Elizabethan playing company, and its legacy.
Anything else you're working on? I mean, bearing in mind that this won't go out for a while.
there are multiple projects kind of on the boil at the moment. A significant amount of that work is around trying to expand the picture of the playhouses and playing companies to map the beyond and before Shakespeare landscape, to understand that this was a really well-established and robust industry by the time the boy from Stratford arrives in London.
Yes, this evolution is that awkward term, of an industry. That's why I've always found the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s really fascinating, in the sense of people, they know how to act, they know how to put on plays, but they don't necessarily know how to be an industry.
Yeah.
And that after the 1590s, my personal interest drops, because it's like they kind of know what they're doing now. I mean, there may be chaos as to what companies doing what and where, but it feels like they're established. Whereas at this time, it's a case of, well, what are the potentials for what they're doing? And we have a lovely oral cue of some rain on the roof. Talking about your interest in weather.
That's right.
Effects on your work.
So, I mean, we didn't even mention today the idea that their touring routes were significantly affected, I think, by significant inundation in Lincolnshire, as at the time was. It was called Holland, around Lincoln and Boston and so on, because their touring routes initially, when we map each year-by-year itinerary, very early we see them going through Norwich, through Lincolnshire, up into Yorkshire. But then in the late 1560s, there's detailed records of significant inundation from storm surges in the lowlands, wiping out their touring passage, their pathway, their route. And so they have to double back around, and that kind of forms an East Anglian circuit. And then they have to separately tour up through the centre to get through to the north. And then they also establish extra circuits elsewhere. The weather and the climate at the time plays a significant part, and certainly the earlier work I did on Newington Butts.
Which, of course, there is an episode of the podcast where exactly right. discussing, where we do talk about the weather, not insignificantly.
That's exactly right. And so I think there's more to be done about the impact that the climate at the time and what that had on weather. And the point is, in short, I can say it was actually quite a volatile period, the 1550s to 1590s and early 1600s. There's this period that we call the Little Ice Age. In Britain, that didn't really manifest itself in significant cold spells until the early 1600s. 1606-07 is sort of the earliest part when that happens. There's only two significant cold years, 1564 and another one in the late 1570s. But around the rest of that time, Britain's climate is very volatile. There's a lot of storm surges, a lot of storms, also a lot of significant periods, several years, including the famed years of famine of 1594 to 1596. All of those are part of that bigger period of volatility, of climate uncertainty at the time.
Right. Well, thank you very much once again. It's lovely to do this chat in person as opposed to on Zoom.
That's right.
in a kitchen with cats. All the rain. So thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then consider throwing us a one-off donation on Ko-fi.com. Or if you'd like a host of bonus material every week, then join our Patreon feed at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. And if donating isn't possible, there is a free subscription tier that will get you some occasional goodies, plus you'll be kept up to date with all our shows. Till next time! Goodbye!